And now Adrian Morby finds out whatever happened to Billy Bunter's form master, Mr. Quelch of Greyfriars School, and asks, was he the man behind Digby Squirrel?
It was always one of my more onerous duties when I was editor of the Telegraph, being buttonholed by self-important grandees who thought they knew better how to handle my organ.
Sir Johnny Bull.
I remember at one particular luncheon, a peer of the realm taking me on one side. Bring back Digby Squirrel, he said. What's become of the author of Little Digby, Mr. Bull? I wasn't Sir Johnny in those days. Digby Squirrel, I said. No idea.
There is no doubt in my mind that Digby Squirrel did more to maintain the special relationship between America and Britain than any other non-elected individual during the Coolidge and Hoover periods.
Edwin McHatter, the Institute of Strategic Studies, Aberystwyth, Illinois.
It is my opinion that it is Digby Squirrel we should thank for the fact that America did not make a preemptive strike on London in 1929.
Of course, he had a classical training. That was what enabled him to work so effectively in code.
Major Vernon Smith.
He was also wholly devoid of a sense of humour. This is important. At Greyfriars, it made him the kind of beak who commanded unquestioning respect. And in the service, of course, it enabled him to keep a straight face, which is the principal quality you need for spying.
An international strategist, a schoolmaster turned spy, and a squirrel. But could they be the same man? Did the English schoolmaster, Horace Henry Samuel Quelch, M.A., change the course of European history under his alias of Digby Squirrel?
Digby Squirrel? No, I did not read it as a child.
Can you describe the column?
I can. It was a nature feature. 2 pages from the back, rendered in story form.
What fun today, boys and nature lovers. Digby saw a little fluffy magpie chick this morning, washing itself and making the sweetest noise. What fun it is to be a squirrel, Digby said. What larks I have, bouncing off the branches. Don't you wish that you were one, boys?
Of course I've seen the file. I was editor for 17 years, you know. And I can tell you that the name of the author of Digby Squirrel is not disclosed. All the relevant correspondence is missing. Just a note debarring further inquiries and signed by one Herbert Vernon Smith at the Ministry of War.
You were at school with Herbert Vernon Smith?
At Greyfriars, aye.
Have you ever asked him about why the author's identity is being kept secret?
Indeed, I have not. I don't think it's anyone's business to question what the government of this country does. And I'm damn certain Smithy won't be party to such tittle-tattle either.
Oh, yes. I don't see any harm in telling you now. Henry Horace Samuel Quelch was my form master in 1926. A gaunt man, strong disciplinarian, austere. His only luxury was a felt bandage round the handle of his cane. When I found out that he'd written the Digby Squirrel column in the Telegraph, I nearly fell off my chair.
How did you come to work with him?
Well, in 1929, I was helping HMG with a spot of bother. There was a lot of suspicion amongst the former allies, and Hank the Yank was as jumpy as everyone else, except that he was doing something pretty drastic about it. Basically, the US military feared attack from just about every source, and they were busy making contingency plans.
America feared invasion from Britain?
Oh, yes. Doodle Dandy was very trigger-happy in 29, firing off randomly in all directions. A pal of mine in Whitehall asked me to think of a way to pacify him, convince him that Britain posed no threat. And that was when I hit on the idea of sending coded messages to friend Hank via an important national newspaper. And this is where Digby Squirrel came in.
I absolutely refute this. And I can tell you I'm not a man who refutes lightly.
Sir Johnny Bull edited the Daily Telegraph from 1950 to 1969.
As far as I am concerned, the War Office sectioned the Digby Squirrel file, and it is not my business, or yours, or the BBC's, to ask why they did this. The problem with Britain today is that people know too much about what politicians are doing. and consequently they have no respect for them. No one ever knew what was going on while I was editing the Telegraph. I can tell you that, young man. Digby Squirrel was a harmless little figure who gathered nuts and had his friends to tea. That is all.
Basically, the Brits were trying to convince the Americans that they had no secret plans to invade U.S. territory.
Edwin McHatter, Carnegie Professor of Applied War at the Institute of Strategic Studies.
For weeks, your secretary Henderson had been scurrying across the Atlantic trying to placate the Hawks, but it is very difficult to prove the non-existence of secret plans, given that their existence would, by definition, be unprovable if they did exist, which they didn't, of course. Inevitably, it didn't work. This was when the British Secret Service came up with a clever idea. They pretended that such invasion plans did exist. Then they used coded messages in the Telegraph, a local London paper, to show how these plans were being sabotaged by Digby Squirrel.
British invasion plans being sabotaged by one man?
By Digby Squirrel, yes.
On his own?
With his furry friends.
Of course. The British are a remarkably compliant and docile nation.
Major Vernon Smith.
The fact that Ed the Mongoose suddenly arrived in the Digby Squirrel column should have raised some suspicions, given that the mongoose is not a creature indigenous to these shores. But it didn't.
But what evidence exists for the claim that coded information was transmitted in the Digby Squirrel column? Anna Safana, head of children's studies at the other University of Cambridge.
Well, during the period of 1923 to 1929, Digby spends most of his time, 57% of it, in Nut Corner, 28% in the surrounding hedgerows, 15% at the Squirrels Institute, and less than 10% in invigorating walks or adventures. But from 1929 onwards, Digby begins to take a regular walk, and 85% of his adventures involve a trip along the cliff tops. He also begins to note the habits of other creatures. A 19% increase in the recording of nest-building activities. And, of course, he develops a conversational relationship with Ed the Mongoose. A staggering 95% of adjectives used in connection with Ed are medium to positive.
And what does that prove to you?
I couldn't say. But it is accurate to within a 5% margin of error.
The whole cliff-top walk element was a result of the deal we came to with Quelch, as was the introduction of Ed the Mongoose and the nest building.
A different view is taken by the backbench MP, Harry Wharton.
In 1926, I was captain of the remove at Greyfriars School. Our form master was Mr. Quelch, and in the school at the time was Johnny Bull, now Sir Johnny, the former editor of the Daily Telegraph, Hurry Jamsit Ram Singh, now the former Nabob of Barneypore, Herbert Vernon Smith, now Major Vernon Smith, and, of course, Frank Nugent, now dead. I shared my study with Frank. He was an exemplary fellow, although in later life he did write some plays of a rather left-wing nature.
What about Mr. Quelch?
Quelch? Oh, no, he didn't write plays.
What did he write?
Write? Well, he was working on a history of Greyfriars we were all sold. Burn in the Midnight Oil, Donnish Pursuits.
Did you know him well?
Frankie.
Quelch.
Oh, good Lord, no. No, I knew Johnny and Inky and Smithy well. And, of course, Frank. I shared a study with Frank, you know. I remember on one occasion, we were kicking, what was his name? Some fat boy, plumber, bummer. Anyway, we were kicking him all round my study, I think, which I shared with Frank. And Wingate came in. Now, he was head prefect and much admired because he was allowed to thrash anyone. Do you know, I've quite forgotten the point of this story.
We traced another Greyfriars alumnus, William George Bunter, to his beachside bungalow in the Seychelles.
Hey?
Mr. Quelch, do you think he might ever have passed coded messages to the Americans?
What? Oh, crikey. Oh, I shouldn't think so. Not Quelch a spy?
And in the south of France, another former Greyfriars boy, the veteran sociologist and sexual commentator, Alonzo Todd.
Horace Quelch was a judicious man, administering a vicious and repressive regime, in which individuality was crushed as fiercely as if it were another form of misbehaviour. Amongst those who were most frequently thrashed were the high-spirited. Herbert Vernon Smith, for instance, Percy Bolsover, and those who were physically different. My cousin Peter, for instance, was something of a daydreamer and unusually tall. William George Bunter was fat and unusually short. They were frequently beaten by Quelch for misdemeanours that might in others have simply been punished by lines. It was as if Henry Horace Samuel felt that physical deviation could be thrashed out of boys, leaving only those who would prove to be good builders of the empire.
Whackings? Yes, there were whackings, I should say. But there was also the occasional spot of revenge.
On Mr. Quelch?
Oh, yes. Well, sworn to secrecy there.
Yeah, I took a few whackings from Quelch in my time.
Herbert Vernon Smith.
He was known as strict but fair. Personally, I thought he was just strict. I got out of Friars as soon as I could. I'd no real use for going on to varsity life. Spent a year of freedom, and then sort of drifted into my little spot of spying.
To understand American foreign policy after World War I, you first have to appreciate the cost in American lives of our involvement in the European conflict, 1917-18, and secondly, the widely held belief that you could catch venereal disease from European lavatory seats. In the midst of the resulting isolationism, the War Department drew up a series of contingency plans to repulse invasion.
Anyway, it seemed that Johnny Yank was convinced that we were going to attack, and no amount of persuasion by HMG would shift this misapprehension. So, my friend in the ministry came up with the idea that we should go along with the doodle-dandy paranoia and feed them information that would prove that such invasion plans did exist, but that they were clearly failing. Do you see? The difficult thing was making the whole operation sufficiently complex and convoluted that they would believe I was sabotaging top-secret plans. At that time, it happened that you could usually meet any number of CIA contacts at the ponds in Hampstead. It was a notorious bathing ground for homosexuals. The CIA hung around in the hope of catching cabinet ministers in compromising positions. Mind you, the rest of the clientele were all Scotland Yard johnnies, hoping to catch the CIA in compromising positions. I was the only civilian on the field. Once in, I soon attracted the attention of a CIA johnny, who put me in touch with this American Colonel johnny. My pose was that I was being blackmailed by Scotland Yard because of a little heterosexual thing of mine they'd uncovered. I was now embittered against my employers, who just happened to be top generals working on plans to invade the US of A, and I was now proposing to wreck those plans with their help. And because I was being watched day and night by a crack squad of respectably married men, I should correspond with my new paymasters via the Digby Squirrel column. They loved it.
Dear boys and nature lovers, today Digby Squirrel met a jolly new friend called Ed the Mongoose. "Hello, Digby," said he, raising his wide-brimmed hat. "Hello," said Digby, in a solid, boyish sort of way. "Who are you?" "I'm your cousin Ed," said the mongoose. "I'm going to see how those silly rooks are getting on with their nest," said Digby Squirrel. "Are you coming?" "Rather," said Ed the mongoose.
The code we had established laid down that the rooks were military planners and their invasion force was the nest. It was basic stuff, but it didn't have to be sophisticated. I was Digby Squiddle, and each week Ed the Mongoose and I would report back or ask our dear old Uncle Sam for what we needed.
Do you know, Ed was so cross with the naughty rooks that he decided that he would have to deal with the bird who was in charge of constructing the nest. "Ah," said Digby. "And what do you plan to do about him?" "Don't worry," said Ed. "I've already shot him with my specially adapted gun."
how they laughed.
No, this gun business proves my point. It's innocent, imaginative adventure stuff. Who ever heard of a mongoose using a gun? Let me tell you something that convinces me you're wrong. Henry Samuel Quelch was an ardent pacifist. So opposed was he to violence that he would severely punish anyone caught scrapping in the form. This is not a man to be laughing about people being shot in the Daily Telegraph. Oh, no. You're wrong. Quite wrong.
Oh, yes. Quelch wrote it. Every word. I used to tell him what had to be said, and he would find a way of rendering it in code.
I asked Alonzo Todd if he believed Major Vernon Smith.
There are two questions here. The first, did Horace Quelch really write the infantile, patronising and anthropomorphic Digby Squirrel column? I do not find this as difficult to believe as some do. Horace, like all his contemporaries, was emotionally frustrated to a degree that we cannot imagine now. Let me tell you an instructive story. William George Bunter's father died towards the end of our fourth year. Horace was asked to inform the boy, but could think of no suitable way. No way that wouldn't involve a possible outburst of embarrassing emotion. Consequently, William George ran up huge bills at the school tuck shop whilst awaiting his weekly postal order. Eventually, the end of term came, and Horace was able to discharge his duty by addressing the envelope containing William's report to Mrs. S. Bunter. When William noticed this, he was informed it was standard practice in the circumstances to send school reports direct to the widow. On your second question, if Horace had found an outlet for his residuum of human compassion, would he allow that channel to be subverted for political reasons? Well, let us not forget Horace's ferocious pacifism. Perhaps he saw this as a way to prevent future conflicts and was willing to sacrifice Digby to that end.
Codswallop! Toddy were always a milksop and a fool, though he were rarely at school. Weak heart, they called it. Weakened by living in a blue funk of having to box and play rugger. If you ask me, there's something not quite right about a man who doesn't want his nose broken. And another thing. How is it that Vernon Smith came by the knowledge that Quelch were right in Digby Squirrel? We only have his word for it. I can't imagine the beak told him, eh? Answer me that. You answer me that.
How did I find out? Well, it involves a peer of the realm, actually. And the thing is, we've always agreed that the matter would not be disclosed.
Alonzo Todd believes you appealed to Mr. Quelch's patriotism.
Does he?
To get his agreement. He thought perhaps because Quelch wouldn't want to see another war in his lifetime.
Oh, dear old Toddy, really? No, Quelch knew it was all rot. Ah, I can see I'm going to have to tell you. I'm sure my partner in crime won't mind now, seeing as he now sits in the House of Lords. Pretty safe there, don't you reckon?
We flew Herbert Vernon Smith out to the Seychelles for his first meeting with Lord Bunter of Hove since the events of July 1928.
When I was leaving Greyfriars at the end of the fifth, this fellow here was also leaving.
Yeah.
Although he was being taken out because his father had just died.
Actually, he'd passed on a year earlier. The pater had been in the city, but now my family couldn't afford to keep me at Greyfriars any longer.
Oh, this chap, he had suffered at Friars. Lessons were dull, the teachers made no attempt to interest us, and anyone who daydreamed got caned. You must have had as many whackings as I did.
More?
More? Oh, he was the class fool and friendless. I felt a bit sorry for him. We all did. But in that kind of environment, it's dangerous to show too much compassion. Anyway, the night before term ended, I crept into Quelch's study. I was going to do something to get my own back. But I thought I was right in the soup when I took one step inside the door and heard this voice. Oh, crikey, it said. Soon as I heard that, I knew it wasn't Quelch, but you.
My idea had been to spread glue across the papers in his desk.
Oh, that had been my idea, too. Weren't very imaginative, were we?
And then you found the manuscript.
Folded away in a drawer. We thought this might be the famous history of Greyfriars.
It would have been a jape to have burnt that.
But then you noticed... Oh, and he's the hero of the hour, this fellow here... Then you noticed that it was Digby Squirrel, the manuscript of some children's serial.
Oh, Lord, yes.
He recognised it, you see, because he read the children's pages in secret.
Crikey, I should say so.
Listen, I said, this is dynamite. I'm going to take some of these sheets. Oh, not the lot, just enough to blackmail him. I remember you laughed.
Sounded a wheeze, but I never imagined he'd do it. We put the rest of the manuscript back. Then I got some glue and smeared it over the construe's quilt you'd left.
I made him promise never to tell I got those papers.
And I made him promise never to tell anyone I'd read Digby Squirrel.
What did you do with the manuscript?
Well, I'd half a mind to paste it up around the school and hope chaps recognised his script. But I was too bloody euphoric that night. The next morning, we left for good. Bunter... Johnny Bull, who was going to play for Yorkshire, and me. You didn't have anyone to collect you, did you? I offered him a lift. My folks had sent a roller. I was saving up that manuscript for a rainy day, and felt I owed our Bunter something. We stopped off at the races, didn't we? Sort of celebratory gesture. And I gave him a fiver to put on a horse. You were tempted not to.
Well, I'd still got outstanding debts in a tuck shop. But Smithy said to me, "You can't tiptoe through life forever, fat man." That's what he said.
And blow me, he blew the entire fiver on a nag. And she came in. That's what started you in racing, wasn't it? Rest, of course, is history. Within 15 years, he had a string of betting shops. And after the war, you cleaned up his property.
I should say so.
And finally, the Tories gave him a peerage in 1979. Lord Bunter of Hove. You deserved it. But I like to think a part of it's down to my little fiver.
Or rather wicked, don't you think?
So Smithy stole the manuscript out of Quelch's desk. I can believe that. Oh, yes, I can believe that Vernon Smith would be caddish enough to steal a manuscript. But I can't believe that that script proved Quelch wrote Digby Squirrel.
If Major Vernon Smith is right, why did Henry Samuel Quelch, alias Digby Squirrel, send coded messages to the US military for 4 years? Was it altruism? Patriotism?
Because I made him, that's why. I had the evidence in his own writing. I had Quelch in my palm. I knew... that if that manuscript circulated at Greyfriars, Quelch would be destroyed. He knew it too. The choice was simple. To allow Digby Squirrel's world to be corrupted, or to be exposed at an English public school as a man of gentleness, compassion, whimsy. Quelch knew he had no choice.
Every year we used to trek down to the alma mater. Bob, Inky if he wasn't abroad, Frankie, Johnny and me. The famous five we were, travelled down to Greyfriars to see the Quelch bird. He never changed. He would welcome old boys back and give them tea, but you always sat up straight, took care of what you said, never ended a sentence with a preposition. Then we'd go and see Goslin, the porter, who was going blind. He'd cuff us as he always did. Cup of tea, Mr. Wharton, he'd say. And we'd sit in the old lodge, reminiscing. I remember one summer, the Quelch bird passed. It was raining, hard, and we were sheltering with Goslin. "Good afternoon, Goslin," he said. "Goodbye, boys. We'll see you next year, sir," I said. "Don't go too near the cliffs, sir," said one of us. Bob, I think. No, it was Smithy. Smithy it was. "Don't walk too near the cliffs, sir. And watch out for the rooks." Quelch turned quite white, you know. Funny, that. Then we all got married. had careers. Frank got in with some left-wing lot, and then it was the war. Quelch died during the war. We were all too busy to really notice. No, I'm wrong. That was Lord Alfred Douglas. It must have been after the war, because Inky had just been assassinated, that was it, and the opening pair for Kent hit 62, and I remember thinking that was exactly old Quelch's age. No, that's not right, because they only scored 27 before rain. Anyway, it rained the day of his funeral. That's it. I think I went. What was it you wanted to know?
Dear boys and nature lovers, what a day Digby has had. Ed the mongoose and your little fairy squirrel friend were off checking that those nasty rooks weren't rebuilding. I'm glad to say they were not. But as Digby said, you can never be too careful with rooks. Better keep an eye on them a bit longer, Ed.
I used to brief him every week. 4 years without exception, unless I was out of the country. Just to make sure he knew he had no choice. Remind him of the consequences. Of course, by 1930 the Yanks had got another bee in their bonnet. But I kept old Quelch's nose to the grindstone for another 18 months. Just to be on the safe side. I did so enjoy our little meetings.
This evening Digby was very tired and went to bed with a good book. I think he may be developing a cold, boys. Poor old Digby.
In Whatever Happened to Mr. Quelch, Smithy was played by Nigel Davenport, Sir Johnny Bull by Cyril Shapps, and Quelch by Andrew Sachs. Other parts were played by Peter Woodthorpe, Eva Haddon, Kerry Shale, and Jonathan Taffler. Gerald Campion played Lord Bunter of Hove. Whatever Happened to Mr. Quelch was written by Adrian Morby and produced in Bristol by Brian King. Next week, at the same time, the girl who spent the 60s screaming every time her grandfather landed his TARDIS. Whatever happened to Doctor Who's granddaughter, Susan?